From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief. State of Belief can be heard across the country weekends on Air America Radio. The program and this podcast are made possible by Interfaith Alliance and its members. For more information on Interfaith Alliance and its work promoting faith and freedom throughout America, visit interfaithalliance.org. And while you're there, please consider supporting State of Belief and this free podcast service by making a tax-deductible donation to Interfaith Alliance Foundation. We need your help to keep State of Belief on the air. Thank you for listening.
Air America Radio and the Interfaith Alliance Foundation present State of Belief, Religion and Radio Done Differently. Here's your host, the Reverend Welton Gaddy.
Welcome, everyone, to State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy, president of Interfaith Alliance. We're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C., where the debate on health care goes on and on and on and on. But on today's show on State of Belief, an English professor tells us why reading the Gospels is unlike her experience of reading any other book.
The stories were so embedded in my consciousness from almost before memory, and they were stories which at one point in my life I thought had in their hands my literal eternal salvation or damnation. Mm-hmm. Now, I might love King Lear, but I never thought I'd go to hell for all eternity if I misread it.
So, what inspired author Mary Gordon to revisit the books of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? She tells us shortly, and she gives us some insight into what fundamentalists leave out when they talk about the life of Jesus. Plus, I'll share some thoughts on the presence of faith groups at the United Nations Summit on Climate Change in Copenhagen, and a rabbi weighs in on the war on Christmas here at home. But first, we turn our attention to the Supreme Court, where earlier this week the justices agreed to hear a First Amendment case that pits a Christian student organization against a California college's anti-discrimination policy. The dispute in question began some 5 years ago at the Hastings College of Law, when a campus group known as the Christian Legal Society refused to admit gay and lesbian students. In response, the law school said it would no longer recognize this small group as an official student organization since its actions went against the school's anti-discrimination policy. The Christian Legal Society then proceeded to sue the school. Its members claimed their First Amendment rights had been violated. Homosexuality is, they say, against their core Christian beliefs. They want a right not to associate with homosexuals. A federal judge ruled in favor of the school, but the students appealed, and the case now travels to the Supreme Court, where it will be heard next March. I'm joined right now by David Savage. David covers the Supreme Court for the Los Angeles Times. He's been a guest on our show before. He will help us with clarification. David, welcome back to State of Belief.
Good to speak with you again.
Does this case really boil down to two competing claims of discrimination, of who is being discriminated against? I guess, is that a fair assessment, and are you surprised the Supreme Court took the case?
Yes and no. I do think it's a good case of where it appears to be this both sides sort of say, we're the victims of discrimination, or at least trying to prevent discrimination. Mm-hmm. From the point of view of the Christian Legal Society, they're saying, why can't we operate as a group, student group, on the Hastings campus and have officers who are committed to what we say are the fundamental religious precepts of our group in the Christian Legal Society? Mm-hmm. And they say that's to require us to do something other than that, it is sort of discriminating against us because of our beliefs. Mm-hmm. The University of California and the Hastings Law School says we have an obligation to make sure that all activities on this campus that are subsidized, including by student fees, are open to all students. And we can't have a group taking student fees and discriminating against gays and lesbians and saying they're not, you know, they're not eligible to participate in this organization. So both sides say they're victims of discrimination.
The student group says that the school administration violated members' rights to expressive association, free speech, free exercise of religion, equal protection of the law. Is there any weight to that argument?
Well, the notion of expressive association is one that the Supreme Court used in 2000 involving a case involving a gay scoutmaster. The Boy Scouts of America had a policy saying no homosexuals could be scoutmasters. Mm-hmm. A New Jersey state court said, you're violating the state anti-discrimination law. The Supreme Court took up the case, 5-4 ruling, ruled for the Boy Scouts, and said this would violate the expressive association of the Scouts. And what they meant, apparently, was that the Scouts have their own policy, their own guidelines. And those guidelines included, you know, that you could not have homosexuals in key positions. That's mm-hmm. part of their message. Mm-hmm. And they said requiring them to have a gay scoutmaster would conflict with their message and therefore violate their principles. And the in this case, the Christian Legal Society is essentially making the same argument that mm-hmm. that we have certain fundamental beliefs and principles in our group, and that having someone who's an openly gay would, you know, send a different message that would conflict with our beliefs, and therefore it violates our First Amendment right to, quote, expressive association. And yes, I think that argument has some plausibility because it's won before in the Supreme Court.
In light of the massive amount of experience you have with precedent, how do you predict this going?
You know, the easy prediction is it'll be a 5-4 vote. The hard prediction is to say which way. Uh-huh. I think, as usual, it will depend on Justice Kennedy. And, you know, he had a decision in the mid-90s that involved an evangelical Christian group from at the University of Virginia. Mm-hmm. In that case, the university said, we will subsidize magazines and newsletters of all of our campus groups. A Christian group put out a magazine that was an evangelical, it was explicitly evangelical. Mm-hmm. And the university said, well, gee, we can't subsidize that because it would violate, we'd be subsidizing religion, and we can't do that. Justice Kennedy said, yes, you can. That's a matter of the free speech rights of the student groups. So if I had to bet my own quarter, I would think in this case, my own money, mm-hmm. Justice Kennedy will see it more from the students, the Christian students, but that's just a guess.
David Savage is Supreme Court correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, always a welcome guest with us. He has great insight into these matters. David, thanks for being with us again on State of Belief.
It was great to be with you.
Just an update before we end this segment. On last week's program, we discussed a proposed law being debated in Uganda. It's known as the Anti-Homosexuality Bill. This legislation included outrageous punishment for gays and lesbians, including life in prison and, in certain cases, the death penalty. Earlier this week, Ugandan Minister of Ethics and Integrity announced that the death penalty and life imprisonment had been stricken from the bill that will later go to Uganda's parliament. Great, we say, but the celebration would have to be short-lived. Homosexuality will still be illegal in Uganda, as it already is, and the anti-homosexuality bill will still include draconian anti-gay measures, not least of which, as Bloomberg News reports, is a clause which forces friends and family members to report LGBT persons to police within 24 hours of learning about that individual's homosexuality or face fines of imprisonment of up to 3 years. In last week's program also, we talked about the link between this legislation in Uganda and religious figures here at home. In fact, We specifically mentioned Pastor Rick Warren of Saddleback Church. Pastor Warren has worked closely with a man named Martin Semple in Uganda, one of the chief proponents of the anti-homosexuality bill. And as of last week's show, Warren had distanced himself from Martin Semple, but he had refused to renounce the legislation. Well, on Thursday of this past week, I received an email from Rick Warren's press people, which included a letter that Pastor Warren had addressed to pastors in Uganda. In this letter, Rick Warren writes that he vigorously condemns the proposed legislation. He goes on to say that he opposes the death penalty and life imprisonment for homosexuality. Well, we, along with a lot of other people in the media, have asked Rick Warren to be clear about what he actually thought about this issue, and to his credit, he is very clear in this message. Now, by my estimation, Pastor Warren sent his letter this past Thursday while the media began reporting that the death penalty and life imprisonment punishments in the bill had already been dropped from the bill the previous day. So did Pastor Warren send this letter only after he knew he'd be addressing an issue that was already politically dead? I don't know. I know what it looks like. I don't know, though. I appreciate his statements, and you'll just have to forgive my skepticism about its timing. I'm Welton Gaddy. There is a lot more to come after this short break, including a rabbi's take on the war on Christmas. Stay tuned. State of Belief. Air America Radio. Welcome back, everybody, to State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy. It's December, so that means it's time once again for the enraged rhetoric over a supposed war on Christmas. Leading the charge this year is an organization called the American Family Association, a group which describes itself as advocates for traditional family values and praises its founder, Donna Wildman, for his work on the, quote, front lines of America's culture war. And now Wildman and company have aimed their artillery at a list of businesses that supposedly want to censor Christmas. The American Family Association even has taken credit for a new ad from The Gap that says Merry Christmas instead of the more inclusive Ready for Holiday Cheer. The group happily concludes that they forced the store into acknowledging their holiday. Well, I'm happy right now to be joined by Rabbi Brad Hirschfield. Rabbi Hirschfield is the author of the book, You Don't Have to Be Wrong for Me to Be Right. He also writes an online column for the Washington Post on faith section. This column is called For God's Sakes, The Uses and Abuses of Politics and Culture. Rabbi Hirschfield, welcome back to State of Belief.
It's good to be with you, Elton.
And first of all, happy Hanukkah.
Thank you, and Merry Christmas to you.
Well, now, you say that some, not all, but some Christians really need to lighten up about this war on Christmas thing, and yet here we are again at the holiday time with groups like the American Family Association boycotting The Gap over saying season's greetings instead of Merry Christmas. You say to me, Merry Christmas. Is this war on Christmas rhetoric ever going to go away?
I don't think it's going to go away as long as fighting the Christmas wars is experienced as a religious act. Right? You know, it's for a lot of people, getting ready for Hanukkah means breaking out the menorah and the candles, and getting ready for Christmas means decorating a tree. There are other people for whom getting ready for these holidays means taking out a colossal chip, putting it right on their shoulder, and broadcasting it to the world.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's, and we're joking a little bit, but I mean it. I think there's a real psychology of victimhood both among certain Jews and certain Christians, and frankly the followers of plenty of other faiths and plenty of atheists, who walk around looking for offenses against them. And my experience is, if you spend your time looking to be hurt, you sure will be.
You know, Brad, that's a wonderful way of stating that, and you're just going to have to remember me next Yom Kippur, because I'm even more cynical than that. I think it's a really good direct mail fundraising tactic as well.
Oh, yeah, I think you're right. So what's interesting about that is then all of us in all of our respective communities have to take some responsibility for the fact that we are all often most susceptible to arguments against those who don't agree with us, as opposed to celebrating the values we most deeply held.
You know,
I think that's really very important. So I think you're right, and I don't think it's cynical, but I think then we're all kind of in this together, to the extent that kind of rattling our cages about threats from others often galvanizes communities more effectively than say, hey, here's what we really believe. Let's go out and celebrate it.
You're so right. Because the bottom line here is that this is not so much about being able to celebrate Christmas individually as it is an effort to make sure that everyone out there is celebrating Christmas.
That's right. I think, and this is where I have the greatest problem with what they did, because I fully understand that there are circumstances in which, and I'm saying this as a rabbi, I think that Christmas has been pushed out of the public square, often unfairly, because the response to the abuse of religion is often to try and banish religion, which I think is unwise.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, I think this response is completely crazy, because in the name of freedom of religious expression, it actually fights not for the right to observe that which we may want to observe,
mm-hmm.
but the insistence that even those who don't share our beliefs go ahead and observe them too. And at that point, it flips from freedom of religion to the very kind of coercive religion, whether that's their intent or not, I can't know, but the kind of coercive religion that actually gets people to say, well, if that's how you think of religion, we'd rather have none of it, thank you very
mm-hmm.
much.
Mm-hmm. Brad, a very serious question. What is it like being a religious minority in this country at Christmas time?
You know, I have to say, I love Christmas time. And I think, and here's where these two topics really touch. I think the reason I, as an American Jew and as a rabbi, can love Christmas is because I have no experience of it as being coerced. I bet 50 years ago, the same Brad Hirschfield wouldn't feel as good about Christmas as I do now. And I just wish that people of faith could appreciate that the greatest honor we bring to our traditions is when we hold them lightly. That doesn't mean we don't take them seriously or observe them carefully. It just means we don't need to coerce others into them. I can see the beauty of other people's holidays, the sacredness of other people's holidays, precisely because no one's forcing me to see them as sacred or beautiful. And I think if we could get that down and understand that, that the beauty and the depth of our respective faith comes clearest when it's accepted most freely.
Oh, what a great guest and what great comments. Rabbi Hirschfield is the author of the book, You Don't Have to Be Wrong for Me to Be Right. He also writes an online column for the Washington Post's On Faith section. The column is called For God's Sakes, The Uses and Abuses of Politics and Culture. He's an author, a lecturer, a radio host, and, of course, a celebrated rabbi. He's also a great thinker and a very sensitive man, and I am delighted that you could be with us on State of Belief.
Well, with my honor, and I always look forward to talking to you. Really, Merry Christmas, Welton, and really thank you for all you're doing.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I'm Welton Gaddy. This is State of Belief. There is a lot more to come on today's show, including my conversation with a Catholic writer who tells us what she learned when she actually sat down and read the Gospels. That's coming up. We'll be right back. This is State of Belief. Hello again, everybody. I'm Welton Gaddy. This is State of Belief. Writer Mary Gordon is the author of 6 novels in total, including Final Payments, The Company of Women, and Pearl, and 1 collection of short stories. She's also penned 2 memoirs about her parents, The Shadow Man and Circling My Mother. But when it came time for her latest project, Mary turned neither to fiction nor to her personal history. She turned instead to the Gospels. Yes, the Gospels, the books of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. In her new book, Reading Jesus, A Writer's Encounter with the Gospels, Mary Gordon shares her experience of actually reading these texts, going back and seeing what was actually written about the life of Jesus and his teachings. The inspiration for the project came, as Mary explains, one day while she was riding in the back of a New York City taxi cab. Here's what she had to say.
Well, I was minding my own business in the back of a taxi, and I heard a radio preacher really shouting in a very, very angry voice and quoting the 25th chapter of Matthew. And that's the chapter in which Jesus says that the sheep will be separated from the goats, and the goats will be sent into everlasting fire. And the preacher was shouting that the goats, or those who would be sent into everlasting fire, were divorcees, abortionists, and homosexuals. And I knew that that was wrong. I knew that the people that Jesus was condemning to everlasting fire were people who had not fed the hungry, had not given drink to the thirsty, had not clothed the naked, had not visited the imprisoned. And because I am a person of faith, and because the Gospels are deeply important to me, I was very concerned that they were being so radically misread. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to read them myself and to confront that radical misreading.
So it was almost a kind of reiteration for yourself that this is what it really says, not what that guy was saying. I guess my question is, why didn't you pick up the phone and call him and tell him to reread it rather than you rereading it?
Well, because I thought it was my job. Before I picked up the phone, I really better be sure I was right. And I was right. And for 2 years, I really explored this reading, and that's because I realized that I had never read the Gospel through before. I'd never begun with Matthew and finished with the last chapter of John. I'd been raised a Roman Catholic in the 50s, and we really weren't encouraged to read Scripture. So I really heard it rather than read it. I heard it read from the altar in a very fragmented way. And I thought, as a reader and a writer, it was really my responsibility to read them as carefully as I would any text that was important to me, and this certainly was more important than almost any I could think of.
What was the experience like reading the Gospels? You are a writer. I have to wonder, did you look at it as a literary critic, or did you read it in the same manner you would read another book? What was reading the Gospels like?
No, I certainly couldn't read it in the way that I had read another book, because, first of all, the stories were so embedded in my consciousness from almost before memory, and they were stories which at one point in my life I thought had in their hands my literal eternal salvation or damnation. Now, I might love King Lear, but I never thought I'd go to hell for all eternity if I misread it. And so on the one hand, they were words in the way that any other text is made of words. But on the other hand, it was a text utterly unlike any other because of the relationship to my lived life and the life of others in history.
How far into this did you have to go before you began to realize something was happening to you in terms of challenging perhaps misconceptions are leading you in new directions?
I think not very far at all, because one of the things that I really insisted upon myself doing was not to skip over anything that I found difficult. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to go that far before you find things that are difficult. And for example, I really focused on the passage in which Jesus tells the young man who's just lost his father, "Don't go bury your father. Follow me."
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, "Wow, that's really a problem for me."
Mm-hmm.
There's no way that I can smooth that over. I can metaphorize it in a way, but it seemed to be a literal encounter. So that kind of butting up against the metaphoric and the literal were always creating tensions for me.
I know that I've seen in some of your other interviews and in some of the reviews that you say you really weren't versed in biblical criticism or an awareness of textual studies, that kind of thing. You talked a while ago about the question of anti-Semitism. As you well know, there are some people who think that a lot of the anti-Semitic words were attributed to Jesus, though maybe not original for him.
Mm-hmm.
Did you engage in that kind of exercise in your reading?
No, I really wasn't interested in that. I mean, not that I denigrated, but it wasn't my project. The point is that some skinhead who opens up the Gospel of John,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, he's not Harold Bloom, and he's
right.
not saying, "Well, you know, some of this diction really probably is Jonas." I mean, he's in a hotel room, and he's a little bit drunk, and he opens up the Gospel of John, and he says, "Jews killed Jesus. I think I'm going to go out and kill me one."
Uh-huh.
So,
uh-huh.
So that's the reality of what this text
sure.
can be, and most of the people, you know, 99.9% of the people who have their family Bible with Aunt Minnie's wedding date in it aren't going to find the scholarship. And yet they are going to say, these are the words, we're going to read them aloud, we're going to, you know, say them to each other at supper, and we're going to live by them. And they have an emotional impact that is, because the words are so strong and the character is so compelling, that is what people are looking for, that scholarship doesn't satisfy. And so although I applaud the scholarship, if the scholarship were really being effective, fundamentalism wouldn't be so effective.
And
what I wanted to say is fundamentalism speaks in an emotional tone, and scholarship does not. And so what I was looking for was a tone that was emotional, but not so hysterical and not so punitive as the fundamentalist tone was. There are other emotions besides fear and punishment. There's consolation. There's mercy. There's hopefulness. Those are emotions, too. It seems to me the evangelicals go for the hotter emotions, particularly the emotion of fear and fear of punishment and shame. And I was really interested in other emotional tones.
That is so well said. You said that you were raised a Catholic, so, and you were familiar with the Gospels some swat. What surprised you most when you went back and actually read these stories as an adult?
One of the things that surprised me was how wonderful they were as stories.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked at, for example, the story of the prodigal son, and I thought, my God, that is a perfect story on any particular grounds that you might look at it. The other thing that I was really interested in is how little Jesus says about sex. He says almost nothing. He's a little bit tough on divorce. But every sexual transgressor that he meets, he's not particularly interested in their sin. He's really more interested in the people who accuse them. The right-wing agenda, which uses Jesus as its poster boy, obsessed with sex in a way that Jesus isn't. And that was a real revelation to me, that there was almost nothing in the Gospels about sex.
if and I don't want to impose my opinion on yours, but if you did it by literal interpretation, Jesus is much more disturbed by the spiritual sin of judgment than any sexual behavior.
Absolutely. And it happens again and again.
When you look at what drove you to reread the Gospels and you look at what came from that experience, what do you see?
I guess one of the things that I see is that I wanted to give other people who might be like me a sense of accompaniment. And I guess for me, there were, you know, there was just a lot of shouting going on.
Mm.
There were, the evangelicals were shouting. Christopher Hitchens was shouting. Everybody was shouting.
Mm-hmm.
And what I wanted to do was to speak in a tone that was a little bit more varied, a little bit more resonant, because I felt there was a need for that. And at least I tried to do it.
And inside you, where it's quiet, where nobody could really hear or see, what was going on?
Well, it was a very strange experience because on the one hand, I had to pray to the person that I was writing about, which was something I'd really never done before. And so I often thought, oh, my God, what am I doing? I have no right to be doing this. And sometimes it would scare me, and I felt, oh, you know, you have really no right to do this. But again, I thought, wait a minute, there are these people who are trying to live by these words and are being shouted out, and I just have to be still and do what I think is the right thing to do.
Mary, listening to you, one of the thoughts that came to mind is, I wonder if she'll ever think about being a minister. And then I thought, no, you've got far too much humility for that.
Also, I'm Roman Catholic. They don't let girls in, I'm afraid.
Well, it was
not
a great
lifetime.
It was a great experience, obviously, and I really do appreciate you writing about it. Mary Gordon is a professor at Barnard College in New York. Her new book is called Reading Jesus, A Writer's Encounter with the Gospels. I recommend it. Mary, thanks so much for spending time with us on State of Belief.
Thanks a whole lot.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
I'm Welton Gaddy. This is State of Belief. Currently, more than 20,000 people are in Copenhagen, Denmark, for the United Nations Summit on Climate Change. Among those in attendance are heads of states and scientists, diplomats, and this year, a surprisingly high number of faith groups. USA Today reports that about 100 representatives from different religious communities are present at the conference. I want to know what they hope to accomplish there. And I'll raise that question in just a moment, but we've got to pause before I can address it. When we come back, some thoughts on faith and the future of climate change policy. That's after this short break. We're coming back, so don't you go anywhere.
The Interfaith Alliance, defending democratic values and promoting religious liberty. Learn more at interfaithalliance.org. State of Belief, once a week, not enough? Check out our website, stateofbelief.com.
Welcome back to State of Belief, everyone. As we come to the end of today's program, we are mindful of the important debate on climate change taking place right now in Copenhagen. The goal of the Copenhagen Assembly is to forge a global strategy for cutting emissions of greenhouse gases that some scientists say are warming the atmosphere of the planet. With representatives of people from 192 different countries present, we all knew the constituents would include leaders of national governments, United Nations agencies, multinational corporations, human rights activists, and yes, yes, good scientists. Few people expected so many religious leaders to show up in Copenhagen. Why are they there? Some people want to know. I'm one of them that wants to know. It's a good question, so let's talk about it. A partial answer to the question is easy. Virtually all of the world's religions cite care of the earth as a primal moral value. There's also the question of social justice. The world's industrial countries produce a majority of the harmful emissions that disproportionately affect developing countries. This is a question of morality, and so religious leaders from all points along the theological spectrum seldom together elsewhere are meeting with one another in Copenhagen. Liberal Christians and members of the National Association of Evangelicals, Conservative and Reformed Jews, Baha'is, Buddhists, Taoists, Hindus, Muslims, Shinto, Sikhs, and others. Now, to be sure, all agree on caring for the earth. But all do not agree on how best to do that, or even on whether or not climate change is real, whether climate change is a consequence of human activities or the result of a divine plan. Some in the faith community question whether tampering with the environment is out of place when God has promised to control the environment. I've heard others wonder whether work on climate change is an expression of faith or demonstration of a lack of faith. U.S. conservative political leaders like Joe Lieberman and Sam Brandbach praise the religious presence in Copenhagen, saying that religious leaders will be a big help. May I ask how? How will they be a big help? How will the religious community make a contribution? Defining a response to climate change as a moral issue can be inspirational and encouraging. I agree. Some religious organizations now own enough land and enterprises that their acceptance of new environmental standards could provide a model for others. Yes. But here's my word of caution. Good intentions do not always produce wise decisions, especially when a strategy in need of development requires expertise that goes beyond the realm of religion. I want scientists to have the loudest voice in these conversations. I want strategies for responsible actions to be drawn from governments and scientists in careful conversation with each other, not from religious leaders citing ancient scriptures. Among the more than 100 religious leaders that have gathered in Copenhagen, I want to hear encouragement for dealing with the toughest issues. But I also want to see a display of the kind of humility that allows science and government to exercise their expertise in developing specific, pragmatic, change-oriented initiatives. I think this is a case in which those who pray best should pray, and those who know science best should launch initiatives based on sound science. Programs that emerge from the intersection of religion, government, and science are usually most effective when each participant in the intersection has respected the boundaries between their particular expertise and that of the other two, so that the programs reflect good religion, effective government, and sound science. We'll keep our eyes on Copenhagen, and very soon we'll try to do an evaluation of what happened there and take a particularly hard look at the role of religion in what happened there. But unfortunately, right now, we're out of time for today. Remember, you can visit us at any time at stateofbelief.com. You go there, please. You can listen to archive shows, you can read our blog, and of course, you can tell us what you think, and we want to hear it. Just click on the Contact Us page and share your thoughts. And don't forget, State of Belief is brought to you each week by Interfaith Alliance. You want to become involved in the cause of religious liberty, you ought to be a part of this organization. Become a member of the Interfaith Alliance. Go to interfaithalliance.org to learn more. Next week on State of Belief, we've got all new conversations about religion, politics, and culture. But until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
Billy Ray was a preacher's son, and when his daddy would visit, he'd come along.
State of Belief. Religion and radio done differently.